Good morning. It's Thursday, February 13th. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, as America battles the flow of fentanyl from across the border, Mexico is fighting the flow of American guns. Some maps have officially adopted the name the Gulf of America, and Trump assumes a new title as chair of the Kennedy Center. But first, President Trump's nominee for education secretary might end up leading a department that's on the administration's cutting block. Linda McMahon's confirmation hearing is today. She'll field questions from senators in the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. At the same time, Trump and Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency are working to shrink the Department of Ed. Here's Trump yesterday answering a reporter who asked, "How soon do you want the Department of Education to be closed?"
Oh, I'd like it to be closed immediately. Look, the Department of Education's a big con job.
Shutting down the department altogether would require congressional approval. It's an idea that's been floated by Republicans for decades, as long as the Department of Education has existed. Many have argued education policy should be handled entirely at the state level, but recent efforts have failed. In a vote last year, 60 Republicans joined every single Democrat in voting against abolishing the department. Janaki Mehta is an education reporter at NPR, and she told us millions of dollars worth of contracts for projects that were already underway have been canceled, including at the Institute of Education Sciences, or IES.
It's one of the country's biggest funders of education research, and slashing this research could mean that the public, so parents, educators, students, policymakers, district officials, they don't have access to key data about things like student achievement, enrollment, school safety, teaching strategies that help students, you name it.
According to Meta sources who have insight into these canceled contracts, at least one program was already being used in classrooms to help students make up lost ground in math, which schools have struggled to make progress on since the pandemic. An employee of IES told Meta they don't understand how Musk can defend the cancellations as being efficient.
The way one of them put it is that by canceling these contracts, they have, in the words of this employee, have wasted millions and millions of dollars.
McMahon could face questions about this from senators today, along with questions about her limited background in education. She is a billionaire best known for leading WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. But she served on Connecticut's State Board of Education for about a year before joining the first Trump administration as the head of the Small Business Administration. Mehta spoke with some of McMahon's former colleagues from the SBA who praised her work.
They told me that she was a really sharp leader who had an eye for bringing efficiency to the public sector. So if she's confirmed, we'll wait and see how those skills might translate to what she's stepping into.
McMahon has recently voiced support for expanding school choice at the K-12 level and providing more transparency in curricula. In higher education, she supports alternatives to college degrees, like apprenticeships, which has bipartisan support. And according to the Washington Post, in her previous role on the Connecticut Board of Education, she supported diversity and equity initiatives, which marks a significant divergence from the president's education policy. So far, all of Trump's nominees to cabinet positions have been confirmed by the Senate, including Tulsi Gabbard to lead National Intelligence, who was confirmed yesterday. When President Trump pulled back from his threat of 25% tariffs on goods from Mexico, he said Mexico must beef up security along the border to stop the flow of illegal drugs like fentanyl into the U.S. Trump even suggested the Mexican government is allied with drug cartels, a claim Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum rejected as slander. She also brought up an issue that often goes overlooked in the battle against drug traffickers, and it's not what flows from Mexico to the U.S., but the other way around. The Wall Street Journal reports 250,000 American guns are estimated to be smuggled into Mexico every year. It happens so reliably and so quickly, in fact, it's been dubbed the Iron River.
As we all know, Americans love their guns.
Zusha Ellenson is a national reporter who covers guns and crime for the Wall Street Journal.
Gun makers sold about 87 million firearms on the U.S. commercial market over the past 5 years. That's a lot of guns. But the problem is not all of them stay here. Quite a few get smuggled out to other countries where it's hard to buy guns. We talked to one former ATF official who described the U.S. as the biggest gun supermarket in the Western Hemisphere.
Mexican officials say this is a long-standing problem. The Journal reports about 70% of guns traced from crime scenes in Mexico between 2014 and 2018 came from the U.S. That's led Mexico to take a new approach.
And that's suing gun manufacturers in America and gun dealers. And they allege that these gun dealers and gun manufacturers are turning a blind eye to smugglers because they make so much money off the guns.
Ellenson says U.S. gun makers argue they're shielded from responsibility by a 2005 law that says they can't be held liable if their guns are used in a crime. And since they manufacture and sell guns legally in the U.S., they're not responsible for how cartels get them or what they do with them. Ellenson told us smuggling weapons from the U.S. into Mexico is a very easy, very straightforward crime.
The gun traffickers or cartels, they find someone who can pass a background check in the U.S. That means someone who has no criminal record. It's sometimes like a single mom who needs some cash, someone with some medical bills who needs some cash. They say, can you go into this gun store and buy me a couple guns and we'll pay you like $1,000. And these people are called straw purchasers. They at some point give it to the trafficker. The trafficker drives it across the border into Mexico. And you may think that would be a hard thing to do. It is not hard to do.
The Journal reports cars headed into Mexico are rarely screened by border officials, partly because of fears that cartels will retaliate against those officials if the flow of weapons stops. In 2022, Congress passed a law enhancing penalties for so-called straw purchasers, people who buy guns to be trafficked. But Ellenson reports prosecutors are reluctant to go after people in difficult financial situations who don't have criminal records. But Ellenson also says a lot can be done to prevent trafficking on both sides of the border.
People who study this issue, they say that more needs to be done to pay attention to gun dealers along the border to make sure they're keeping a good eye out for people who might be buying guns for traffickers. These folks who study the issue also say it would be good for Mexico to strengthen its criminal justice system so that they could really assist in investigations into gun trafficking. We spoke to former federal agents who said it's quite difficult to pursue investigations down in Mexico because of the corruption in the ranks of police there.
When President Trump issued an executive order to rename the Gulf of Mexico, which has been called that for more than 400 years, to the Gulf of America, it raised a bunch of questions. Like, is he allowed to unilaterally decide something like that? And do other governments have to follow Trump's lead? Trump has the power to order changes to geographical names as they're used on official U.S. maps, but he can't force other governments to adopt those changes. There's really no official agreed-upon system used to name boundaries and geographical features on our planet. In fact, there's a long history of government disputes over how bodies of water in particular are named. NPR cites a few famous examples. There's the sea south of China, which is known to much of the world as the South China Sea. In Vietnam, it's the Eastern Sea. The Philippines has designated parts of it as the West Philippine Sea. Another example is the water that separates the Arabian Peninsula from Iran, which much of the world calls the Persian Gulf, while Arab nations in the region call it the Arabian Gulf. But back to the Gulf in question. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum rejected the name change and encouraged other countries to join her.
Para poder cambiar un nombre de un mar internacional, pues no es un país quien lo cambia.
She said it's not up to one country to decide what to call an international body of water. And she jokingly shot back at the president that she might start calling North America Mexican America, as she stood before a map from the early 1600s that shows North America was once labeled that way. Some Mexican citizens expressed similar takes. Reuters spoke to one man on the coast shortly after Trump made his announcement.
Honestly, it's wrong, because the Gulf of Mexico will always be the Gulf of Mexico. That's the way it is, and it doesn't need to change.
The AP also went to the Gulf to speak to some locals on the U.S. side. One man said his family had a long history of being out on boats in the area, and he welcomes the change.
I've been spending every 4th of July just about of my whole life on the Gulf of Mexico, and it would be great to spend 4th of July on the Gulf of America. Sounds like fun.
Wired has been reporting on how digital maps are handling Trump's order. On Google Maps, users in the United States now see this body of water labeled as the Gulf of America. Google users in Mexico see the Gulf of Mexico, and users outside of those countries see both names listed. Apple Maps renamed it to Gulf of America for all U.S. users, but MapQuest and a number of map services run by other countries have not made the change. Media companies are in a similar gray area, and the Trump administration has already taken action against those unwilling to comply. The president barred reporters with the Associated Press from the Oval Office this week after the organization decided to officially continue using the Gulf of Mexico while also acknowledging Trump's preferred name, Gulf of America. The AP called it a plain violation of their First Amendment rights. Before we let you go, a few other stories out of Washington that we're following. A federal judge lifted the pause on President Trump's deferred resignation program for federal employees, and the Trump administration quickly closed the offer to any more workers who might have been considering it. The program had been halted since last Thursday after unions representing government employees sued, saying Trump didn't have the authority to offer such buyouts. Yesterday, the judge decided the unions lacked the legal standing to bring the suit. According to the White House, at the time when the program was frozen last week, 65,000 workers had accepted the deal. In other D.C. news, a top Democrat in the Senate says Kash Patel, Trump's nominee to lead the FBI, may have perjured himself during his confirmation hearing. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He says he's received credible evidence that Patel has been personally directing a purge of employees at the Bureau before being confirmed by the Senate. In his hearing, when New Jersey Senator Cory Booker brought up the topic, here's how it went.
Are you aware of any plans or discussions to punish in any way, including termination, FBI agents or personnel associated with Trump investigations?
I'm not aware of that, Senator.
CNBC notes lying to Congress, under oath or not, is a federal crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison, but charges are rarely filed. In response to Durbin's accusation, a Patel spokesperson dismissed it as, quote, secondhand gossip. Durbin has asked the DOJ to investigate. The Senate votes today on whether to move Patel's nomination forward. And finally, the board of the Kennedy Center installed President Trump as its new chairman, carrying out a plan that Trump announced last week to take over the historic arts institution. The board also fired President Deborah Rutter and appointed Richard Grenell, former acting director of national intelligence, as its interim president. Trump had a contentious relationship with the Kennedy Center, bucking the tradition of attending the institution's honors ceremony during his first term. Trump said he was remaking the center because, quote, we didn't like what they were showing, and said it's, quote, not going to be woke. CNN reports Trump replaced all board members appointed by Democratic presidents with his own appointees. The move also prompted musician Ben Folds to step away as an artistic advisor. Television producer Shonda Rhimes and opera singer Renee Fleming also resigned their positions. The Kennedy Center is funded by a mix of government dollars, ticket sales, and private donations. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. More and more people are expected to travel further into space in the coming years. The New Yorker asks, is deep space something the human body can handle? If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.